So for our penultimate episode of Season 2, I spoke with Rabbi Jeremy Gordon at his Shul of New London Synagogue in St John's Wood in January 2020. Our chat focused on marriage under Masorti, conservative in America, and how it contrasts with the British default that is Orthodox weddings. We also spoke about one of the dominant figures of 20th century British Jewry, Rabbi Louis Jacobs. Let's get into it. So I'm here at New London Synagogue on Abbey Road, home of the Beatles, and also home of Rabbi Jeremy Gordon. How are you doing?
I'm good.
But let's get on to it. You want to chat a bit about weddings and your specialism, right?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, I'm a congregational rabbi, and I think the congregational rabbi is the GP of the rabbi world. Or, you know, I sometimes think of the analogy of the decathlete. You know, that you have to be able to sprint, you have to be able to shot put, you have to be able to long jump, and you know, you have to be able to do a decent wedding for people. I got ordained about two weeks before I got married. And so my time in rabbinical school was very much kind of tied up with thinking about what that ceremony would be like.
Why did you do that? Getting married is pressure. Becoming a rabbi is pressure.
Yeah.
And you thought, oh, I'll do them both.
I mean, and also in the midst of that, I had a kind of international relocation. So I was at rabbinical school in New York. So I had to pack up 5 years of my life in New York and parcel everything back up to come back to this country. That's okay. We're, you know, from whatever it is, 15 years distance, we're doing fine. But, you know, when I was in New York, I was part of an attitude towards Judaism that doesn't have as many people supporting it in London as it does on the Upper West Side of New York. You know, on the Upper West Side of New York, you get a lot of very egalitarian-minded, halakhically literate people. So there was all kinds of discussion going on about how do you pull off actually the thing that I think every couple wants. And I guess, you know, I'll kind of come back round to it. What I think every couple wants is, minor kind of exceptions aside, they want equal committed sexual exclusivity and trust in each other. And the problem for any couple who want to do that in terms of availing themselves of 2,000 years of rabbinic history on that is that's just not where the Torah or rabbinic Judaism comes at what marriage is. And you can start to see it in just infinite numbers of ways all the way through the rabbinic stories. Who is betrothed, you know, who is married off, who pays who. You can see that functioning all the way through the Bible. And by the time you get into rabbinic Judaism, you start seeing some very, very, I think, disturbing language for anybody who's interested in a kind of balanced attitude in a relationship between a man and a wife.
So by rabbinic Judaism, you're meaning Talmud?
Right. Rabbinic Judaism is beginning while the Second Temple is still standing. By the time the Second Temple falls in the year 70, it's Yochanan ben Zakkai becomes the kind of the first great founder of rabbinic Judaism. He goes off, he founds a yeshiva, and over the next 130 years, the Mishnah is canonized and finalized, and that's the guts of rabbinic Judaism. And everything really that happens as a sort of tributaries arising out of that heart of the Mishnah. So the Mishnah on marriage, which is in this order on women, opens by saying that a woman is acquired in one of three ways, and the word that is used is niknate. And to be koneh something literally means to take acquisition of it. A woman is acquired in one of three ways: with kesef, shtar, and bir, with money, with a document, and with what the rabbis at a later point called use of the bed. And I just can't read that to mean anything other than acquired as a chattel. And you'll see all kinds of ways that that gets reflected into classic rabbinic Judaism. One of the most typical is to do with what happens under a chuppah in a United Synagogue in this country, right? In the UK, or an Orthodox wedding ceremony, that the man provides the kesef, literally silver or item of value, usually a ring, and says this kind of formula, but the woman doesn't or isn't allowed to utter that formula and to exchange money back. And the logic is fine if you accept the premise, right? The logic is that the woman has been acquired by the man. So how can the woman then acquire the man back? It's that she is nicknate, she has been acquired, so therefore she has no acquisitorial potency. And if you don't accept the premise, then, you know, that's a different kind of an issue. And then when you look at something like the classic United Synagogue in this country, Orthodox Ketubah, you will see that the language is that the groom obligates themselves, obligates himself with a run of different obligations towards a woman. Vitzivit marat, and the bride consented to these terms and to become his wife. So you've got this kind of disconnect that the groom has all the obligations to clothe and to provide food and money and, for what it's worth, sexual pleasure and various other things to the bride. The bride doesn't have any of those obligations back to the groom. And then the flip side of that, which is the one that usually kind of causes the eyebrows to pop up when I kind of chat to couples about it, and I'll say more about how I can end up chatting to couples about it, is that the groom in a classic United Synagogue of this country, ketubah, does not take upon themselves the obligation to sexual exclusivity to the bride. So that you've got this kind of huge disconnect.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I'll give you some options of things that you can do. You know, you'll sometimes hear this kind of muttering of something in the sort of the deepest recesses of ultra-Orthodox Judaism, of the Pelegesh, this kind of a permitted sexual relationship for a married man with somebody who is not his wife, with a woman who's not his wife, as a kind of outlet for sexual urges that for some reason or other are not being met. And there's a short story, I can't remember if it's Edgar Carrot or, you know, it's somebody like that playing with that kind of stuff. For the simple reason that if you go through a classic Orthodox wedding, there is no sexual exclusivity undertook by the groom. So what you end up with is the acquisition of a woman qua chattel and sexual exclusivity on behalf of the wife to the husband, but not from the husband to the wife, and the obligation to care and clothe and love and everything else of the husband to the wife, but not of the wife to the husband. In other words, if you go through a classic Orthodox wedding, you have successfully undertaken a whole range of things that don't match what any couple that I've ever met thought that they were letting themselves in for. I'm not a huge troublemaker. My dear friend, Rabbi Joel Levy, is a much bigger troublemaker than I am. And he kind of wrote an article where he kind of suggested this, which is, if I say a bunch of things that I don't mean, and somebody else then says a bunch of things that they don't mean back to me, then you have accomplished nothing. So if I were to say to somebody, I am acquiring you and I take upon myself a bunch of obligations, and you sort of accept those kinds of terms, but I don't mean it and you don't really accept it, then actually Kiddushin Latofsin, like, we haven't actually achieved anything. Now, this is quite a radical understanding for people such as your good self who married under the auspices of the United Synagogue of this country, right? Sorry, I keep saying United Synagogue of this country just because there's also the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism in North America. So I think that there is a genuine problem with people undergoing Orthodox weddings when they don't accept that they are being nicknamed, when they don't accept that they're being acquired, and their understanding of what the mutual obligations are not mutual.
So what I'd say is that prior to getting married, myself and my wife, we both, and I can't speak for her, but I can speak of our conversations, we are liberally minded. I think listeners of the podcast know I'm pretty liberally minded. But at the same time, there was a few reasons why we wanted to marry under United Synagogue and under the auspices of the Chief Rabbi. It's the perceived correctly or incorrectly as the gold standard. So in terms of wherever we go in the world, that wedding will be considered a kosher wedding by everybody. I'm not talking about the ethics of that. I'm talking about it's the reality. The other is about family. So there would have been family that would not have come to our wedding if it was held here. They just wouldn't have done. And I think what we both were aware of the acquisition part of it and troubled by that. Because however much you say that the woman has to accept the ketubah, it's not quite the same, right? That it's a contract that only I am part of, and it's all revolving around my obligations, as you said. But the other part, and I think this is the one that I felt the most, was, and there were certain things we didn't do, so we didn't do the seven times round, because that felt, you don't have to do it. But the tradition, we could, me particularly, I think for a groom in an Orthodox wedding, it's particularly intense, because you do the mincha of Yom Kippur, which the woman is not obligated to do. followed by a tish where everyone's being nice, which, by the way, the minister said, no, you can't have women at the tish. And I went, show me where it says you can't have women at a tish.
Right.
Women were allowed at the tish, so a win's a win. And so everyone's being very nice to me, and that's really weird because I don't like people being that nice to me. It's really, really uncomfortable. Stop, it feels unearned. But anyway, that's a chip on my shoulder. I go from that into the Bedecken room, and it's intense. It's really, really intense. Everything's building. You're fasting, you know, and then on top of that, I go, well, I know that Jewish weddings have been done like this for thousands of years. Mm. And however much I feel that some of this is incredibly sexist and really uncomfortable, can I not just own that discomfort? Can I not just go, this is uncomfortable? I accept it's uncomfortable. I acknowledge and own that discomfort. But at the end of it, I'm marrying the love of my life, right? Mm. And so does all that matter once everything's been signed, sealed, delivered? Because we have a very equal marriage. Mm-hmm. We do. We now have the option to go wherever we want. So we can go as orthodox as we want. We can go as non-orthodox as we want. Mm. And you might have a snide comment every so often, but I know you wouldn't. Mm. You know what I mean? But it provides a freedom that, however nice all the things that you've said are, and they are, and I do, and I on a moral level probably agree with them, I know I have that freedom to do what I want.
Mm-hmm. I mean, listen, you can do whatever you like. And I'm not interested in welcoming you to my synagogue and, you know, pointing out all the ways that you are a terrible person.
There's a lot more than just that, by the way.
And I'm not really interested in kind of reinterrogating the ceremony that you decided to do with your wife. And I wish you every muzzle and bracha and happiness and everything else. But let me respond to some of the kind of theoretical kind of questions that you raised, right? Among people who are unsure whether or not you have successfully married would be me. Now, you can decide that you are more worried by the agudath of B'nai Barak or me, and you can choose to, and this is, I think, the really key thing, you can choose to vote with your feet and your money of synagogue membership and affiliation, whatever, you know, and by so doing, you strengthen the future of a Jewish path. Now, I'll come back to this, but let me do a little kind of diversion. Used to be 15 years ago that the key time when you would need a United Synagogue kosher ketubah was that if you want to send your kid to JFS, or, I mean, there are now many more schools than there were, but that kind of, you know, cadre of schools under the auspices of the United Synagogue and the chief rabbi.
I always just clarify, just for listeners that don't know, JFS, Jewish Free School, big Jewish high school in London.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for what it's worth, JFS, right? It's not called Jewish Free School anymore. But like, it used to be that if you wanted to send your kid to that school, you used to have to provide an Orthodox overseen ketubah. And that if you couldn't produce this document, then you would need to get a document that belonged to the mother's mother, right? The maternal parents, the maternal grandparents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they were taken to what was then the House of Lords, the Supreme Court, for an offense against racial relations legislation. And JFS was found to be acting in a racist manner. So all of that has now been torn up and replaced. And this was under the leadership of former chief rabbi for the United Hebrew Congregations, now Lord Jonathan Sachs, when he said, forget all this business of certificates. If you want to send your child to a school under the auspices of the chief rabbi in this country, you need to demonstrate that you are Jewish by what you do, rather than by whether or not you have an Orthodox ketubah or a non-Orthodox ketubah. So, you know, that piece is gone. But let me now come back to this kind of question, which is, you know, let's say that you and your wife decide that you're going to relocate to someplace in the world where the only shul in town is an ultra-Orthodox shul, and, you know, you want to go there.
Pass for shul.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not even sure where that place is, right? I mean, a couple of things to say. You know, one is there is no legal Jewish category of a couple having a child together outside of marriage, right? So that terrible English word of the bastard or the illegitimate child doesn't exist Jewishly. In other words, if there were to be a couple who they didn't have a ketubah from anybody, but they turn up with the child and they say to, you know, an Orthodox synagogue environment, hi, you know, we're Jewish, this child is Jewish, there's nothing that can be done. Now, I mean, you know, whether or not they could marry a Cohen or not is a slightly separate issue. But like, there is no, I mean, the term that sometimes gets translated as bastard, which is this term mumsa, and we can talk about that as another time. It only applies if the woman was married to somebody else and had a child with a second man, right? So there's nothing to be gained from this status of everybody recognizing it. Or rather, I don't know what it is. Like, and I will sometimes say to people for whom this is a concern, because by the way, when I meet with people, I say, can you prove to me that you're Jewish? Can you give me a piece of paper that I can look at? And they present me with a piece of paper, which I look at, and I say, you know what I recommend doing? Just take a scan of this and send it to your Gmail account or whatever, you know, that you save a copy of your passport and your driving license, because it doesn't matter. And then there's this question about your family. And like, you know, I tend not to like contemporary management speak when discussing marriage, right? But actually this term stakeholders is a really, really interesting question when it comes to marriage, which is when two people come together, like who are the stakeholders in that? And I completely get and love the fact that very often stakeholders sometimes, yeah, I'll give you the best ridiculous example of that. It was fairly early on in my rabbinic career. I know this because I'm about to mark the bar mitzvah of the child of this marriage. But I was doing a wedding for this couple, and I said, you know, I'm Ashkenaz. I'm you know, my family come from, you know, Odessa and Lithuania and that whole kind of world. And I said, and the bride doesn't wear any jewelry. And this woman went white. Absolutely white. And she said, oh, but it's really important that I wear jewelry. And I said, no, women don't wear jewelry. I mean, I was too young and stupid not to realize. And she comes back to me next week and says, I've spoken to my grandmother, who says that she has the family wedding jewelry and that if I don't wear it at the wedding, she will never speak to me again. And so this is a woman who traces her ancestry back through Sephardi. I can't remember if it was like Iraq or North Africa. And this is the ridiculous thing. As it says in the book of Isaiah, I shall go out to meet you bejeweled as a bride goes to meet her husband, which is, you know, just not a bath-proof text. So it turned out that I should have just been more careful about this idea of stakeholders. So one of the things that I say to people, and I talk about this in the context of breaking glass at the end of a ceremony, and also that strange thing of tanaim. It's the closest thing that the ceremony has to an engagement party. You'll only really see it in quite orthodox environments. But a plate is broken as the date of the wedding is announced. Like somehow you're...
See, that's a vort.
Yeah, a vort, right? Yes, yeah, yes, tanaim yes. In the Hebrew vort in the Yiddish vort, because the groom gives a devar Torah, devar meaning vort. One of the things that I always say is you are breaking something when you get married. You are breaking the primary relationship of a person to their parents and reconstructing a new primary relationship, which is a person to their spouse. If you plan a wedding, know that something will get broken. And that's fine. And that's normal. We don't in Judaism do perfect weddings. Here are some of the things that used to be a lot clearer a generation ago and are now less clear. Who's paying for it? Who gets to decide who comes? Who gets to decide what the bride wears, what the groom wears, whether or not there's a band before or after, the canapes before? And who owns this wedding? And you can't, like in my experience, get from, you know, I've met this girl, I've met this boy that I really like, to breaking the glass without the pressures of the intergenerational breakage, with an overlay of lots of money, with an overlay of sex, without that presenting tension somehow. I just, you know, even you can't. And this gets around to the bit that we were just talking about when we first started, which is the proof of a success of a marriage is not perfection. It's the ability to handle brokenness. And I think that's just like a tremendously important thing for anybody who is newlywed or less newlywed to know. Like, it's not about how perfect can you make it, because that's not our human role. That's God's arena, and our arena is to work out how to behave in and how to handle brokenness. Who do you give the ability to determine what happens at a wedding to? Now, it may well be that you will decide to give to Uncle so-and-so, Mummy such-and-such, the ability to determine certain things. You know, when I know when I got married, a huge number of things got handed over. The big fluke was that all the things that my father-in-law, who had very, very strong feelings about things like canapes. Like, I didn't care about any of those. And I cared all about the ceremony. He couldn't care less about the ceremony. So it was, you know, my wife wanted to be in charge of the music. And I, you know, so it was fine, you know. But at a certain point, you have to decide how to play that kind of stakeholder issue. And this is the thing for me about the decisions that egalitarianly minded, mutually committing people who decide to get married in Orthodox synagogues have to accept, which is that they have modelled out for another generation this thing. And that they have also voted in favour of the strength of that kind of Orthodox half Nelson. You have to do it with us because otherwise it won't be X, Y, and Z. You know, my feeling is that, I don't know, you know, 80, 90% of the members of the United Synagogue of this country don't like the non-egalitarian nature of Jewish wedding, but they all kind of wander through it, thereby ensuring that the United Synagogue continues to be the largest single place where people pay dues. And dues make the resources, and resources make the ability to send kids on fancy trips to Israel for massively reduced salary, which means that what you've done is booted the problem down a generation and modelled for your children in ways that I think are inarguable. I mean, I completely get that when the two of you are sat across your dinner table, I would not be able to guess who has cooked that meal or who has paid for that meal or who has earned the money to pay for that meal or who has to come home early from work because the little kid is sick. And, you know, like I'm prepared to accept all of that. But I think it's inarguable that we are playing out gendered roles within our family relationships, within our marital relationships, so easily. And to destabilize those is so difficult. I mean, I'm a congregational rabbi, which means that I work, as it were, on Shabbos, and I work a lot on Sunday. And I realized fairly early on that I needed to take my day off during the week, you know? So you know, my equivalent of most observant Jews, Shabbos, is Wednesday. And on Wednesday, when our children were little, before they went to school, I would take my kids to the mother and baby sing-along at the library until I protested, and it now doesn't get called the mother and baby sing-along at the library. And I would take them to the gym, and I remember being in the gym, and I would get dagger looks from all these women, successful, professional, massively competent women who had kind of like forsaken on their professional existence to be the primary caregiver to their children. And I didn't breastfeed. I mean, like, you know, we're not going to be able to wind back biology, but we have so much more work to do to wind back sociology. And when you start putting God's will on top of sociology, or when you start justifying the frankly unjustifiable in religious language, it's very, very dangerous. We did an amazing thing at the Shore here in New London on Shabbos. We're just in the very, very last process of becoming fully egalitarian. We've done all the decision-making and consulting and halachic setting out of opinions and everything else. And we'll be fully egalitarian by the end of March. And I invited the first ordained female rabbi of this country, Rabbi Jackie Tabek, who was ordained by a list of rabbis, including Rabbi Louis Jacobs, who was the founding rabbi of New London Synagogue and the dominant figure in any kind of Jewish scholarship in the 20th century, and dominant figure. And Rabbi Louis Jacobs told then Jackie, why don't you get ordained, because there's no problem with you being a female rabbi, and then signed on to her ordination certificate. And the ordination ceremony, and I only found this out on Shabbos, was held at New London Synagogue. And we together looked at what Rabbi Louis Jacobs, blessed memory, wrote and said about women. He wrote this article in the JC in 1972, three or four. By the way, it's on this amazing website of all of Rabbi Louis Jacobs's everything that's been put together, where he said that the chief rabbi of the time had launched a study into whether or not women could be on the management boards of United Synagogues. And Louis said, you know, we all know how this is going to come out. Women are going to be allowed to put fruit up in the sukkah and to arrange the flowers on Shavuot, but they won't be allowed to do management. And anybody who tries to justify this in a society where we've had a female prime minister in the state of Israel, right? So he's 1973. He couldn't reference Margaret Thatcher, although I don't know if she was at the time a minister and the education minister or whatever it was. He says, you know, and anybody who tries to justify that is turning the synagogue into the last place of reaction. I just thought it was a great sentence. And there is a problem that we are justifying the synagogue as a place of reaction. I can apply for an exemption from the law of this country that you have to offer a job equally to a man or to a woman if I hide behind a religious fig leaf. And somehow in all of that fold the decisions of such people who, although they don't like it and don't accept it and wish to have nothing to do with it, nonetheless go through a wedding under the auspices of the Orthodox in this country.
There's nothing that you've said, apart from, like, obviously the Louis Jacobs stuff, and I didn't know a lot of that, and it's fascinating from a historical basis, but on a philosophical basis, there's nothing that you said that I hadn't, well, me and my now wife had not considered And it is difficult. And it wasn't an easy choice for us. Does it not provide me, Hayden, with a credibility when I am talking with an Orthodox rabbi? Or I'm arguing with myself here. It could just be I'm saying however much argument I do, I decide with my wallet. There is that. So
I tell you what I would feel if I was an Orthodox rabbi and you would come to me and say, you know, hi, Orthodox Rabbi Jeremy, although I don't accept an A, B and a C, I did get married under Orthodox auspices. I would go, great, all I need to do is keep ratcheting your elbow behind your back and pulling, and you'll toe the line quite nicely when push comes to shove. I mean,
It's fair.
I mean, this comes back again and again to the incredible privilege that I have to serve as a rabbi in Rabbi Louis Jacobs's synagogue. So, you know, let me do just a little bit of the Jacobs affair story. You know, Rabbi Louis Jacobs, most brilliant scholar of his generation, it was suggested to him that he leaves his pulpit at the New West End and goes to Jews College to train rabbis, so that when he became the chief rabbi, as everybody assumed that he would know his junior rabbis.
And just to clarify, this is Orthodox.
This is all, yes, in the New West End is Orthodox. Yes. Rabbi Louis Jacobs' rabbinic ordination is Orthodox, and his learning is impeccably, I mean, sensationally, traditionally Orthodox, although by this point he's picking up a PhD as well. And he goes to Jews College and at a certain point writes up a bunch of adult ed classes that he taught at the New West End as a book called We Have Reason to Believe. And in them he says, don't worry if you don't accept that the entire Torah came down on Sinai in 40 days. By the way, in Judaism, you don't have to. Look at all these people who didn't. There's this thing in the Yerushalmi and the Talmud. There's this thing in Ibn Ezra in one of the great commentaries on the Talmud, on the Torah, and so on and so on and so on. And still, there is still reason to care about traditional observance, Shabbat, Kashrut, that kind of stuff. And as he is en route to becoming the principal of Jews College, this book kind of suddenly is read by the ultra-Orthodox who say, this person is not becoming the chief rabbi, is not becoming the principal of Jews College. And the way that that came down the ladder was that Rabbi Louis Jacobs was given the opportunity to apologize and to recant. And he turned around and said, I can't apologize for what I believe to be true. And by the way, I don't accept that this is a Jewishly inappropriate thing for me to feel, believe, know. And he was given the opportunity to bend, and he didn't. And many times, I mean, I grew up in New London. My parents moved into the area when I was one. He was the rabbi of my bar mitzvah, and it is just an amazing shock, as well as an honor for me that I'm the rabbi here. The thing that he kind of talked about, I mean, he would say these things, you know, the good thing about being in hot water all the time is that it keeps you clean. But the other thing that he would say is that the more that you bend, the more supple you become. Now, you know, if you're practicing yoga, that's a good thing. But if you want to live a life of integrity, it's dangerous. So, I mean, I don't know what the right decision was for you and your wife. And in the nicest possible way, I don't care. But the other side of it is a huge problem for me, because I am aware of a number of people who say to me things like, oh, we would love to join your shul, but there aren't enough, insert as appropriate, people davening three times a day, people studying the Talmud on a regular basis, people coming to shul on a Shabbos. What's your 7 day a week shacharit minyan like, morning service minyan like? To which I just don't have good enough answers, because we don't have enough people. One of the things that I think is happening in ultra-Orthodox, and particularly that, you know, half-Nelsoning sort of edge of orthodoxy, is that they're waiting for everybody else to dribble away, because they think they've got numbers on their side, and they think they've got numbers on their side for two reasons. One is their birth rates are very high. Gegas and Tahit, and, you know, Puravu, you should be fruitful and multiply, and I wish them every happiness. And, maybe there's an ecological question to be asked about that, but that's all fine. But also because they know that if they put up clear blue water anytime anybody gets a little bit too dodgy, and they chop those people off, and they keep people who are prepared to, when push comes to shove, be shoved, they think they're going to win the numbers battle. You know, when I die, and I, you know, if I get to heaven and God turns around to me and says, Jeremy, what do you mean you've found some way of thinking that the Torah didn't come down as one singular communication over 40 days. Like, what kind of an idiot are you? I will have nothing else to say other than, God, I'm really sorry. I got it. You know, I just completely misunderstood what you were saying to me. But I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, I genuinely think that the way that I understand Jewish theology is probably historistically correct.
Doesn't everyone think that?
Well, I don't know. I don't accept that. I don't think that everybody who talks theology believes the things that they say. I think that there are a lot of people who tow safe theological ropes. And I think that there are a lot of people, and Rabbi Louis Jacobs used to say this about many of his former colleagues within the United Synagogue. Like, they believe the same thing as me. Why aren't they turning around and saying, yes, we accept that? You know, and there was a time when Rabbi Louis Jacobs and his kind of close supporters seemed to think there was going to be this run of United Synagogue rabbis who would all turn around to the further right-wing reaches of the ultra-Orthodox control of the United Synagogue and say, get off our back. And you see whispers of it happening every now and again. I'll stay off examples in this country because there are, you know, I mean, I understand why someone wouldn't. One of the interesting things about the difference between the United Synagogue rabbiner and the Mizrahi rabbiner is that I'm employed by the members of my community. Now, a United Synagogue person could say, well, I'm not going to tell them they're a bunch of unrepentant sinners because they pay my wages. And that's a fair critique to level at me. But on the other hand, it does mean that a United Synagogue rabbi who crosses the United Synagogue can't be employed as a United Synagogue rabbi anywhere. Now, that's a very different level of seriousness. I mean, I understand someone who's unwilling to stand that one down. I would never judge anybody for saying that.
There is one extra thing that I'd like to throw into the mix as well. And that is, in Leeds, the choice is Orthodox Reform. Mm. There is a Masorti community. Mm-hmm. It's a lovely community. I know them very well. They're friends of mine, but it's small. Yeah. It's small to the point of everyone in the Masorti community, when there isn't the monthly Masorti service, either goes to Reform or Orthodox. So if you were then married in anything other than Orthodox, your default is therefore Reform. Because it's not like London, where there is the luxury of choice.
Listen, I don't think there's this massive luxury of choice in London either. Certainly not if you don't want to walk, if you don't want to use, motorised transportation on Shabbat. I mean, could happen in Leeds. There probably are some people who should really be members of a federation or a right-wing Orthodox environment in Leeds, who live in Leeds. And then there's probably a whole lot more who are members of the United Synagogue who are not orthoprax, they're not Shomer Shabbat, they're not accepting of a kind of a literalist theology. You know, they see marriage as a meeting, as an egalitarian meeting between two people mutually taking upon each other the same obligations, all of that. You know, what if all of those people left? I hear, and I get the steep swallowing, you know, and then everybody starts talking about burial society memberships and who am I going to be buried next
year? It's horrendous.
And I understand that, you know, once upon a time I knew some economics, right? There is no freedom of movement, and it's in the interest of the Orthodox of this, you know, in this country, to have maximal constraints on freedom of movement. And I would also hesitate to say freedom of information. Do they encourage people to go to universities and study how the Torah came to be on the basis that that's a freedom of knowledge thing? Or are they slightly nervous and don't really want to get into that kind of stuff? If you are someone, and this isn't, you know, I'm not trying to make a kind of party political point, but if you are someone who believes that the maximum utility comes when you have maximum freedom of movement and freedom of information, that's actually in the longer term interest of things like the possibility of Judaism to be vibrant and exciting for another generation. My goodness, we all have our work cut out. If you want to be on the side of the restrictions of freedom of knowledge and freedom of movement, and I can understand why there are reasons for it. And that, you know, like who needs to be, this is a really interesting question, right? Who needs to be a chalutz, right? Who needs to be a pioneer? That word, you know, the chalutzim, you know, so that's what I associate with the founding of the State of Israel, treading over the, you know, the desert sands, you know, clutching the nothing with which they escaped the concentration camps. I mean, like, you know, these people drained the swamps and built the land, you know, but like a couple of generations later, contemporary Israelis, they don't want to be chalutzim anymore. You know, like they don't want to, you know, I don't want Amazon, you know, like, it's fine, you know, like, and the aim of Judaism is not to force everybody to be a chalutz. because going back to the 1980s, women were told, go away, learn a bit, come back when you've learned enough. And many of them did, you know, that generation of pioneering. Again, we're back at that word. You know, there's a kind of Blue Greenberg kind of world of orthodox people who, you know, felt that they, if they could understand, they would turn back up at the doors of the Bet Din with the knowledge of Talmud that they could accrue over the course of a generation. And the Bet Din would say, ah, oh, welcome in. They would confront the Beth Din with these kind of, you know, the key line of the Talmud on whether or not women can have an aliyah. Everybody goes up to make up the minion of seven, even a woman, even a child, right? So it says that you can be counted as one of the people who receives an aliyah on Shabbat morning, even if you are a woman. But we don't call women up mipnei kavadat sibur because it's the honor of the community, right? You know, they thought that they could do that and that they could look up all the other appearances of kavadat sibur, that you don't allow someone to go up there. They've got holes in their clothes through which you can see their undergarments or, you know, or worse. And you don't make people hang around in shul rolling a sefer Torah from one bit to another because it's dishonorable to the community to make them wait. And they would say, look, can you not see that that when it says kavod sibur, it just means that you don't treat us honorably, or that, and you know, let's not be rude about where the rabbis were 1800 years ago. 1800 years ago, if you were calling a woman to read from the Torah, it meant that you didn't have a man to read. And by the way that it used to be done 1800 years ago was that you didn't have someone to read the aliyah for yourself. If you were called to the Torah, you read your own aliyah. So, you know, it was a much more technical, much more complicated thing to do. And they just thought that the Orthodox Beit Din of the world would go, yes, right you are, let's start calling up women. And it turns out the goalposts just kept getting moved. Jews used to love lots of questions, right? Used to really rate the ability to write questions. Something very badly went wrong in Judaism when the phrase to be a master of questioning, Baal Shela, became the phrase that is used to refer to someone who was Orthodox and then stops being Orthodox. I mean, like, you know, that's a terrible thing that's happened to Judaism. You could go up there with, let's say, had you made a different set of decisions with a non-Orthodox ketubah, and the rabbi would have said, oh, I'm not sure about this. And you could say, well, what difference as a matter of halakha does it mean? Are you saying that I am living with my wife in licentiousness, you know, in znut? To which I would be pretty sure that he would have to say no, you know, although, you know, you never know. There are people, I'm not really aware of it ever having happened to me, but one of my other dear colleagues in the Mizrahi movement would share that they were just tremendously hurt that good members of their community, when they fell in love with a potential spouse from a United Synagogue background, that he would do the wedding. And that would be on the Sunday with a thingy and a, you know, and a cake and everything else. And then on Monday, they would kind of sort of disappear off to their local United Synagogue where they would sort of have a sort of little impromptu chuppah. And it always struck me that the sensible thing to say to the rabbi who's officiating the second time is, when you say the blessing in the middle of the wedding ceremony, right, and you invoke God's name, is that a bracha v'tala or not, right? A bracha v'tala is a wasted use of God's name. You're not supposed to take God's name in vain, second of the Ten Commandments, right? You know, big deal stuff. So I think that a Orthodox rabbi who does an Orthodox wedding ceremony for a couple who were married under Masorti, and you know, nothing against liberal or reform, auspices, if they do that blessing, they have taken God's name in vain. Now that's, I think that's...
Well, I think that's a bit extreme, just in terms of...
Here's my proof. Okay. Here's my proof. If you do get married under Masorti or reform or liberal auspices, assuming you could have been married in the United Synagogue, so let's take the whole conversion piece out of it. If you get divorced, the London Beth Din will set up a get for you. Now, the technical term for that is reich kiddushin. It smells literally a scent of kiddushin, or a thing that I quite like to translate. It smells a bit like, you know, you got married properly. But I think that they will recognize an effective marriage, in which case they recognize that that blessing has been done. Listen, I'm not suggesting they're going to burn in hell forever, but I am suggesting that it is 99.9% sociology and 0.01% halakha.
Right, which is probably right, you know. And I'm not going to argue with a learned rabbi about the intricacies of halakha. I think it's more about taking God's name in vain. It's and that might go into the realm of I don't understand ancient Aramaic, which is what the ketubah is written in. I know it's said in English as well, but it's not the same because I don't get to interpret it myself, and I don't understand Hebrew. So I know the odd word, but if I'm reading the Talmud, I'm reading it in English, right? I know the various words for God in Hebrew, and I know when I'm saying God's name, and I can invoke it in that regard. And then it's something about intent versus language. And as someone who is, you know, I'm a performer, I'm a performance poet, I was an English teacher, I understand that every word has a meaning and an importance behind it. But it's the meaning and the importance that the individual person puts behind it and the meaning that others hear. So the people that came to our wedding know the type of people that we are. They know the intent to which we were doing it. So is an argument that beyond the theological argument that there is, that actually the intent of it is important. The point being, there's loads of troubling things that are in Judaism, and we still do them because it's part of our history and our heritage, and we struggle with the conflict. But that doesn't mean that people won't have Brit Milah, so circumcision for the boys, however uncomfortable that might be, they'll still do it. Could discomfort not be a good thing?
I think discomfort's a fantastic thing. That's the simplest question you've asked people after today. Yeah, discomfort's great. Discomfort's great. Pursuing comfort is the problem. There's a lovely Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, right? Like, you don't have to do it all, but you're just not free from being, you're not free to walk away from it, which I think is to say the decisions that all of us make with our religious lives. And by the way, marriage is a fantastic example of this. Anybody who wants things to go entirely their own way never gets married, or rather it never lasts, right? You're continually having to make, in any kind of meeting of two people, and certainly when it comes to like the religious decisions that we make, you're continually having to learn how to negotiate difference and not have it all your own way and not insist on having it all your own way. But that doesn't mean that you have to walk away from it. And so, let me be nice to you. I've been giving you a bit of a hard time. You're a good fighter. You fight good fights. And I love the podcast. I love the stuff that you are prepared to champion and you're prepared to out and make sure is out there and talk through, and it's incredibly important. And not everybody needs to be the same kind of rebel. It's actually really nice for me as a congregation rabbi to have some people who they don't insist on seeing exactly what my sermon is on Saturday morning before they decide whether or not to come to shul or not. All of that's absolutely fine. But I don't know if you, I'm just struggling to remember the name of the movie. Arrival, right? A couple
brilliant
of years
film.
Ago.
Brilliant
stunning,
film.
Stunning movie based on the Ted Chiang. By the way, in that Ted Chiang collection of short stories, an unbelievable story set in the Tower of Babel. I recommend Ted Chiang to anybody. But the idea of that story, Arrival, is this thing called, I might get this wrong, like the Bohr-Sapir hypothesis. But the idea behind it is this idea of linguistics, which is that the language that we use colors the way that our brain gets wired, and it colors the way that we are capable of reaching understandings of things, right? So I'm not going to spoil the movie, but if you've seen the movie, you understand how that plays out, which is to say that if we use language like the chairman, even in this kind of pronoun, this complicated world that we live in with as far as pronouns are concerned, where if we say things like, I'd like to think of a rabbi in your mind, what color is his hair, right? As opposed to what color is their hair, right? Is that if we don't really start to pay attention at a much more granular level, much more careful level as to how we are training our own brains, halacha kama v'kama, how much the more so, please God by you, the brains of these tiny creatures, these children who are crazily placed in our care, right? For us to impose our own view of the world on top of. If we don't get much, much, much more careful, then we are abnegating the ability to create the world that we want for our futures and for the futures of our children. And that goes just way across the board. So a good dose of discomfort is almost certainly necessary. Sometimes you have to comfort people who are afflicted. Sometimes you have to afflict people who are comfortable. One of the great tasks for me as a rabbi is to work out who I'm talking to and what they need and whether or not I'm really, I'm capable of getting that balance right, because I get it wrong. To be honest, I more often get it wrong. What do I tend to do? I tend to comfort people a lot, which probably means that I've spent more time comforted people. Now, what's interesting for me about just lob this grenade in before we go, you know, disentangling Kinyan from Kiddushin, acquisition from sanctified exclusivity, is that I think that's freeing, that frees up the term Kiddushin for same-sex partners. So if a same-sex partner, you know, a partner come to me and say, you know, we want sanctified exclusivity, I can turn around to them and say, here's a model for you. And you know, you could sort out the grammar, and there's some of the Shevah Brachot that need rewording and some of those kinds of things. But that, I think, works. The Shevah Brachot are explicitly about a man and a woman, but the Shevah Brachot they're about a different thing. They're about permitting one person to another person. They're not about sanctified exclusivity. Some of the Shevah Brachot, you don't need to reword at all. Yotzeha Adam, you know, the creator of Adam, that's still good. Brachot's still good.
I do have to ask a question. There's a difference, though, I think, between talking about being sensitive to people's perspectives and outlooks and the rigidity of the text. And I'm aware that Masorti places an importance on the text in a way that, and again, this isn't as a judgment call, in a way that, say, Reform and Liberal are a bit more Reform and Liberal about it, but Masorti does take that seriously. So is it mental hoops that you want to do in order to make Judaism work in the way you want it to work? Or, I mean, is that what it is?
Sort of, but no, right? I won't accept that on this issue, right? Because don't tell me that you got married to your wonderful wife according to the Bible. If you would have done that, then the money would have gone in the opposite direction, right? The ketubah wouldn't have had an escrow that you would have had to have put down for her, but rather she would have paid, you know, her family would have paid a mohar, a bride price to you. The whole thing is completely backwards. And there is this amazing, amazing, staggering transformation in the nature of marriage between the end of the Bible and the beginning of the Mishnah. So Judaism has always changed. Rabbi Professor Judith Hauptmann, in her exquisite book, Rereading the Rabbis, traces the invention of the entire mechanics of the ketubah as this absolutely astounding, far-thinking, far-reaching way of saving women from destitution if they were to be abandoned by their husbands. And that was a huge issue. Frankly, it's still an issue today, right? Women get a little bit old, they get a little bit less perky, and men walk out on their women, right? There is civil legislation ensuring proper division of resources, and then there is the ketubah. And the ketubah, I mean, the language is fascinating, right? How much is 200 zuz? How much is 200 zuz, which is the language of a traditional ketubah? I know what you can buy for two zuz. You know what you buy for two zuz? Tezab and bitrei. Right? You buy, right? And anyone who knows the Seder night song, you buy a goat for two zuzim. So 200 zuz buys you 100 goats. You are no longer an economically destitute person. Brilliant. I doff my kippah to the rabbis who came up with that radical transformation. And it was so radical, it was maybe 1,500 years, maybe 1,700 years at a push, 1,800 years ahead of its time. It's now 200 years behind its time. So why are we holding on to the ability of rabbinic Judaism to be forward-thinking and providing astounding leadership in issues of allowing men and women to do the very thing that we theologically believe God wants them to do by tying ourselves up in knots over a ketubah, which in itself is the way in which Judaism invents a way of allowing people to do the thing that we want people to be able to do? What we're in danger of doing is protecting, I mean, in technical terms, the tafel, and losing the ikar, protecting the form and losing the essence. We've got it backwards.
I can't argue against that point. And I really can't argue against, because you've been thinking about this. For how many years have you been mulling all these things? It must be a while, right?
Well, listen, I'll tell you when it's done. I do have to go because I'm on the subject of having to look after kids. And my wife's out. She's working tonight. I've got to get home and put the kids to bed. When I decided I wanted to be a rabbi, I knew I wanted to be a serious rabbi. You know, and I knew I wanted to have an ownership over the Masorah, over this incredible tradition that we have. And at the time, like, it was difficult for me to read Hebrew, right? So, I mean, I had a long way to go. And I packed myself off to Israel, and I didn't know, you know, whether or not I was going to end up on the left wing of Orthodoxy or as a Masorti, as a conservative rabbi. And I had a dear Orthodox friend, rabbi, who I respected enormously. And I'd spent about 3 months in yeshiva, and I kind of made an appointment to go and see my dear Orthodox rabbi, you know, rabbi friend. And I sat down with them. Interesting, right? Sat down with him. And I said, look, you know, can we start here? Can we do the bracha in the morning, Shalot Asani Isha? That there is a morning blessing where we bless God for all these astounding, miraculous things that God did for us, like allowing us to see and allowing us to have clothes to wear and walk straight and everything else. And we bless God for not making us a slave and for not making us a woman. When I say we, I mean in the language that's there for men in the Siddur. I thought that if this rabbi was going to be able to persuade me that this was somehow okay, it would be fine. And I thought, if this rabbi could tell me, don't worry, don't bother, it might be fine. But actually, neither of those two things happened. And this was the best Orthodox rabbi that I knew. They weren't able to tell me that I didn't have to say it, because I don't think an Orthodox rabbi can tell a man not to say that bracha. And for sure, they didn't come within a million miles of justifying that as a bracha. And I remember walking back from the Old City and realizing that I was never going to be an Orthodox rabbi. And I wasn't an Orthodox Jew. And in terms of discomfort and comfort and everything else, I made my home here.
Wow. What an excellent point to end on. Rabbi Jeremy Gordon, thank you very much.
Well, now I'm certainly sure I'm not sure. And what could be more Jewish than that? Until next time, bagelers.